You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in to the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, August 29th, the feast day of the Passion of St. John the Baptist, remembering his martyrdom. We'll talk about that a little bit today, the way not only things happened, but the way they always happen. Also, my guest during the second hour, Rick Becker. Rick, who's become somewhat of a monthly guest on the program since I discovered his excellent blog, God Haunted Lunatic. He also writes for the National Catholic Register. And Rick, a fascinating story of his own conversion to the faith, as well as how he now brings his faith to bear teaching nursing, practicing nursing. He's up there in the South Bend, Indiana area. But anyway, excellent article in a recent issue of the Register on the pen pal relationship or the written correspondence between the British author of his best-known book, Brideshead Revisited, Evelyn Waugh, and the Trappist monk and priest, Thomas Merton. Really fascinating stuff because, we in many ways are in an era in which the pen pal written correspondence relationship is really on the decline, if it exists much at all, and particularly the kind of honest writing that Waugh and Merton did with each other. So we'll get Becker's take on that, but he thinks it's also a window into our own ongoing conversion. And of course, one of his conversion influences, Dorothy Day, makes an appearance in the book as well. So we'll talk about him. Well, not talk about him. We'll talk to him. I guess we could talk about Rick, too. Just hope he didn't find out. Also, religious habits and Catholic culture wars and wondering who has the harder job. I'll leave you guessing on who I'm comparing there. 573-4BREAD-4, if you want to chime in, be on the program today. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text that number. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your thoughts on Facebook or on Twitter. I'll have a question of the day in the next segment. Hope you had a great weekend. I'm primed and ready to go. Cup of coffee in hand in my stainless steel bread box media cup. It'll keep it hot throughout the whole show today, which will be nice. I had a pretty chill weekend for the most part. Friday night, got to do my PA work. I actually had a doubleheader game at our local Catholic high school. It's their annual bowl game, big fundraiser, and they have a first game involving a couple of prominent teams from the state, including one here locally, trying to draw out some of the public school crowd. And then the second game, the nightcap, always involves the host team, Lexington Catholic, this year against St. Xavier out of Louisville, which is a traditional powerhouse. Lexington, just to give you a comparative, Lexington Catholic is a 3A school in terms of the rankings in the state of Kentucky athletic system. 3A, and we have about 800 total students, boys and girls. St. X is an all-boys school, and my guess is they've got somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 students. All boys, their football team is like an ocean getting off the bus. An ocean of yellow and green. So you're at a disadvantage going in, plus the fact that Lexington Catholic lost two players to ACL injuries last Friday and a boatload of experience, particularly on offense, off last year's team. Here I was calling the PA. I was hoping it wouldn't be too bad of a shellacking. Much to my shock, Lexington Catholic jumps out to a 28-0 first half lead, including a 90-yard pick six from one of Catholic's players. It was amazing. Alas, a team like St. X, of course, doesn't just give up, unfortunately. They, over the rest of the game, rattled off 42 unanswered points to win. But, boy, it was fun while it lasted. And kudos to our kids on a hot, hot night, cramping up. Some guys going both ways. Played a heck of a game. Then, got to go to Mass yesterday. I've had in my mind
the closing hymn. I have these hymns sometimes from our Catholic hymn book that I relate to either to popular tunes or popular artists. Like yesterday, we sang the closing hymn. I call it the Dave Brubeck hymn. Dave Brubeck, the master of the 5/4 meter. That's why jazz enthusiasts always protest May the 4th being called Star Wars Day, you know. May the 4th be with you. Because they say, hey, it's 5/4. That's Dave Brubeck Day. Sing of the Lord's goodness, Father of all wisdom, come to him and bless his name. That's the hymn. So it's got that little jazzy kick to it. Interesting. Now it's like an earworm. I can't get rid of it. And if you've got it now, you're welcome. And then earlier in the week, the song We Are Called at the school mass the other day that opens with the what sounds like the opening line of Come Sail Away by Styx. Come live in the light. I'm sailing away. Anyway, but then it changes, of course, after that. But anyway, it's a Monday. What are you going to do? Sorry about that. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime or call in. 573-4BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. As I said today, the memorial of the Passion of St. John the Baptist. As is pointed out in Catholic culture, there are only three persons in the liturgical calendar whose births and deaths are both honored. And that, of course, is Our Lord, Our Lady, and St. John the Baptist. Back on June 24th, we celebrated the Nativity of St. John the Baptist. As you recall from the early chapters of Luke, there are these twin, actually, nativity stories that go back and forth between the two, interweaving, so to speak, John the Baptist and, of course, his cousin, Jesus of Nazareth. Well, John the Baptist's own passion preceded our Lord's. And so when you think about those interweaving narratives of Elizabeth and Zechariah on the one hand, and Mary, of course, and Joseph on the other, when you realize the shadow that extends over both infancy narratives, because both of these celebrated sons, whose birth were announced by angels, both would die brutal deaths at the hands of a corrupt government. Anyway, St. John the Baptist, of course, you probably are very familiar with the story. It's laid out here in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verses 17 through 29. It was Herod who had John the Baptist arrested and bound in prison on account of Herodias, to whom Herod was married, even though her former husband, his brother Philip, was still alive. Now, Herod, like a lot of politicians, wanted to play the religion card when it best served him. And Herod, who is at least part Jewish, liked to play the Jewish card when it served him. That's why, just like his father, he didn't take kindly to someone consider themselves to be a king of the Jews or a baby who could be a potential king of the Jews, because he wanted him to see himself as king of the Jews. John the Baptist, though, said, okay, you want to call yourself king of the Jews? What are you doing with an unlawful marriage? It's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. John the Baptist, relentless in his preaching against Herod, so much so that Herodias, Herod's wife, harbored a grudge against him and wanted to kill him, but was unable to do so. Why? Because Herod feared John. I always think that's the most interesting detail in that gospel reading for today. For what possible reason would Herod fear John? You know, to quote Stalin, how many divisions has the Pope? How many divisions has John? Answer, zero. You are Herod. You have soldiers at your command. Who is this desert hippie eating locusts and honey and wearing a hair shirt, preaching like a crazed lunatic? And yet Herod feared John because of his moral authority. He knew him to be a righteous and holy man and kept him in custody. See, here's the thing about this whole account of St. John the Baptist. In many ways, it's like something I said about the book of Genesis a couple weeks ago. I've been reading this outstanding book on the book of Genesis called The Beginning of Wisdom by Leon Cass. And he said the thing that's so powerful about the book of Genesis and the narratives that comprise that colossal, epic masterpiece of a biblical book is that you see through a window of Genesis our own human experience. As he says, it's not that this is the way things happened. It's the way things always happen. The story of the passion of St. John the Baptist, much like that. It's the story of how things always happen. Those who are pretenders to power on human thrones, raised up and deposed by God, by his own sovereign will, are somehow uneasy and insecure around the voice of moral authority, and they want to snuff it out. It's the way things always happen. It's the way they've happened since time immemorial and will continue to happen. John the Baptist martyrdom, a quintessential, prototypical expression of that. Now, we share through our baptism in Christ's prophetic office. May happen to us, too. We'll talk about that more in the second hour. My question today when we come back, so don't go anywhere. St. John the Baptist, pray for us. We'll be back. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this feast day of the Passion of St. John the Baptist. Pray for the people of Aleppo, Syria, and all these places where there's just so much conflict. I was reading yesterday a helicopter dropped a couple of barrel bombs where people had gathered for a wake. People gathered for a wake after there have been several others killed, 15 people killed in a barrel bombing Thursday. And there they're gathered together in mourning, and more barrel bombs come. According to this CNN article, barrel bombs, oil drums filled with explosives and shrapnel dropped by aircraft. And what a sadistic instrument. Killed more than 3,000 civilians in Aleppo in 2014. According to a report last year, human rights organizations said barrel bombs are a common tactic of the Syrian government, which has been fighting rebels in a civil war since 2011. I also saw where there was another suicide bomb in Iraq yesterday. There's just so much suffering going on. We just need to keep all these folks in our prayers. That's for sure. Anyway, welcome back into the show here on Breadbox Media. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, go to breadboxmedia.com. Simple enough. One of the things that, as I've said, I'm excited about is the idea of the parish stream, and that is a internet stream for your particular parish that when you download the app for your digital device, if your parish has a parish stream, we've got a couple who are in the midst of developing those, be a great idea for your parish too. You get all the same programming 24/7 from all our different contributors across the country, but you get your own commercial breaks that are specific to your parish. Whether those are weather updates, whether those are announcements from your pastor or other people, other leaders there, volunteers or staff, you could give devotional thoughts. You could have commercials from advertisers within the parish, much like the back of the bulletin. And it can be a great source of catechesis, communion, community formation, and fundraising as well. all through the Breadbox Media stream for your parish. So check all that out. You can also find out about our different contributors, listen to podcasts of shows maybe you've missed or parts of this show through Podbean, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also become a friend of your favorite show and love to have you be a friend of this show. And through a monthly contribution, receive access to exclusive online content. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day, really inspired by the conversation I'm going to have next hour with Rick Becker. Rick Becker, who really reviewed a book by Mary Frances Cody called Merton and Waugh, A Monk, A Crusty Old Man, and the Seven-Story Mountain. It was a book of correspondence, really, of extant letters between the Trappist monk living here in Kentucky, where we're broadcasting from, in beautiful Gethsemane. I still have not been there, which is horrible to admit. But Thomas Merton, Trappist monk, Catholic convert, really wrote one of the great spiritual autobiographies of the last several centuries, I think, The Seven-Story Mountain. And Evelyn Waugh, the sort of crotchety British Catholic author who wrote A Bride's Head Revisited, among other things, and a person who had very strong feelings about writing style and so forth. And he and Merton exchanged many letters in which Waugh was, I guess, somewhat, we'll kindly say, constructively critical of Merton's verbosity. But it's got to be an interesting book. I need to pick it up myself and read it. Rick Becker's done the heavy lifting. He'll talk about it. But it's got me thinking about letter writing. And in the days of email, text, social media, how much actual handwritten letter writing do we do? Where you actually send it in the mail to somebody and they write back and so forth. It seems to be an antiquated thing. And yet, at the same time, doesn't everybody love to get a letter in the mail? So that's my question of the day is do you still send handwritten letters? And if so, how often? And primarily to whom? Love to hear from you on that. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I posted a link with the question on Facebook, which you can check out. Twitter as well, Mike Allen Show, the handle, The Lost Art of Letter Writing. I used to do a lot more handwritten correspondence, particularly related to ministry. When I was in youth ministry, back in my Methodist days, I always felt like it was really important to send handwritten notes to youth in the youth group. Just little things. You know, maybe I'd seen where somebody had scored a goal in their high school soccer game, or they'd had some achievement, or just somebody who just wanted to let them know that I appreciated them coming to youth group. It was a way of building a rapport and of self-esteem, I felt like, in a young person. And so I would kind of make that a habit. I would get some little, pack of 10 note cards, and not an extremely long note, but I'd write a handwritten note, mail it to them in the mail. And, I know that there were a number of those young people who held on to those. They really meant something to them. And, of course, we've been on the receiving end as well. When someone takes the time to write you longhand a letter, it's quite a gift. We don't do it nearly as often, though, I don't think. So I'd love to hear your feedback on that. Do you still send handwritten letters? And if so, how often and to whom? Kim chiming in on Facebook says, I more often write a few lines and an encouragement card to those I think might need to know someone is praying for them rather than a full-blown letter. All right, fair enough. 573-4BREAD-4, call or text, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Sports stuff over the weekend. I already told you about my local high school's losing a game, for hard-fought game, to a much bigger school. At least my Tampa Bay Bucks won Friday night in their exhibition game, third exhibition game. Football is in the air this weekend, of course. Kickoff weekend for college football, the following weekend for the NFL. So getting pretty exciting. The big news, of course, mostly exhibition games don't bring a lot of interest. But one big event that happened at the 49ers game is that quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who, mercy, it's only been, 3 years ago, he was starting in the Super Bowl against the Ravens, a game that they would ultimately lose. But Kaepernick sitting out the national anthem and said, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing here, that until this country begins to make an end to the oppression of African Americans and people of other people of color, he will not stand and pretend that this country is what it claims to be, a land of the free and the home of the brave. He will continue to do this, he says, as a principled stand by not standing every time the national anthem is played. Of course, it is brought about typical polarized reaction. There are those who are decrying him, and including some of his fellow NFL players, including a ex-49er Boone who ripped Kaepernick for his shameful act. Many people seeing it as a slap in the face of the military and of a country that has made it possible for him to be a multi-millionaire. Others are saying, hey, Colin Kaepernick, you know, the flag represents the right to do exactly what he's doing. And if we don't give him the space to speak his mind, then we really aren't the land of the free. I'm a little torn, I'll admit. I can understand those who are critical of Kaepernick. It does seem to thin to go on and on about oppression when you're making millions of dollars. At the same time, you know, I go back the other way, and we are critical of athletes often because they're only in it for themselves. Aren't we? I mean, we do. We criticize athletes. They're narcissistic and so forth. Well, here's a guy, even if you disagree with him, even if you think he's woefully misguided, here's a guy who's willing to stick it out, you know, stick his chin out for something he believes in. He does. I mean, he as far as I can gather, he's not going to gain anything from this. Probably going to cost him a good bit. So at the same time, I can respect his decision to do what he's doing. So I kind of go back and forth. I haven't really settled in yet. And you know what? Guess what? That's okay. We don't have to have a lockdown tight opinion about every single thing. I think that's one of the falsehoods of our culture. If you've got a comment on that, would love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Let's see if we can sneak in at least one What Were You Thinking award here before the break. I like this as we span the globe. Go dumb or go home, as we like to say. Well, these guys went dumb, and they're going home. Canadian border guards find rocket launchers and grenades. Canadian border guards uncovered two grenades and a rocket launcher in a car occupied by two men from Louisiana. Get this. They were attempting to cross the Peace Bridge on July 3rd. When their vehicle was searched, officers found a disposable rocket launcher tube and two grenades. They were seized because they were not declared and prohibited. What? Did you just think that was going to slide by? Really? You know, they're not scared of firearms in Canada, but, you know, grenades and rocket launchers, different thing altogether. We'll give you the rest when we come back from the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour. Back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Question of the day. Do you still send handwritten letters? And if so, how often and usually to whom? 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Still remember the summer of 1986. I'd been dating my wife for a little over a year, and she had the opportunity to go do a summer internship in Jackson, Mississippi, about 10 or 11 hours away from our home here in Lexington, Kentucky. And I remember it well. Of course, these are the days before cell phones and, you know, email and all the rest. So it was pretty brutal. And long distance actually cost money then, too. So I remember we vowed when she left. I still remember her driving away. And I ain't too proud to admit that I shed a tear or two with my sweetheart driving away. She had me hooked. Anyway, we decided we were going to write each other every day, and we largely did over the course of that summer. Boy, it was a different day, wasn't it? My goodness. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, if you want to chime in on that question, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter as well. We've got, of course, big week, not only football season, college football season starting this weekend, but even bigger stakes going on in Rome this weekend with the canonization of Blessed Mother Teresa, lifted to the altars of the worldwide church as Saint Teresa of Calcutta. And I'm really excited that Thursday we're going to have on the program together John Allen and Inez San Martin of Cruxnow. That should be a lot of fun. They're there in the midst of it, and as the excitement is building, as Pope Francis will be canonizing Mother Teresa. I believe it's on Sunday, but there'll be a lot of buzz about that as it unfolds, and a very important saint, I think, for our age. Anyway, let's get back to our What Were You Thinking awards, because, again, spanning the globe, I still can't get over these guys deciding they're going to sneak into Canada with a rocket launcher. How about this? This is from out of Elkhart, Indiana. Elkhart murder suspect tells judge he's seen trial on TV, doesn't need attorney. A man charged in a 2015 Elkhart murder and criminal confinement case insisted Thursday on representing himself in court, despite warnings from the judge it could be the worst decision of his life. Elkhart Judge Terry Shoemaker granted the request of Leon Tyson, 28, to represent himself as he stands trial on charges related to the shooting death of Tommy Strouder. Tyson had signed a waiver and said he wanted to proceed with the trial without a lawyer. Shoemaker said he would only allow him to give up his right to a lawyer if he understood what that meant for his trial, that the murder charge could carry a sentence of up to 65 years. And the level 3 felony charge of criminal confinement, a sentence of up to 16 years. He would likely serve 75% of the potential sentences if convicted, meaning he could be imprisoned for at least 60 years. The judge pointed out that attorneys have skills vital to a trial such as Tyson, such as considering eyewitnesses, cross-examining those witnesses, evidence, and the necessary legal rules and procedures. Tyson would have to do the same and would not receive any special treatment acting as his own attorney. Tyson told the judge he would educate himself on what he needed to do and would represent himself to the best of my abilities, but was not able to answer many of Shoemaker's questions to the judge's satisfaction, such as the number of peremptory challenges allowed in jury selection and the applicability of federal case law. Asked if he'd ever seen a trial, Tyson answered, on TV. So let's hope this guy reconsiders, because seriously, I mean, you could be going away for a long, long time. And what you think, because what you watched Law and Order, boom, boom, whatever that little musical thing that, sorry, that was a bad attempt for a Law and Order. But anyway, that's our number two nominee. You think it can't get any worse? Well, let's go dumb or go home with our winner of our What Were You Thinking award for the day. This out of the great state of Georgia.
Marietta teacher faces disciplinary action for slavery game. A Marietta teacher is facing disciplinary action for what one grandmother calls a demeaning educational game. Dolores Bunch Keemer said she knew something was wrong when her 10-year-old granddaughter came home from school on Tuesday afternoon. She said her granddaughter is the only African-American girl in the classroom and was asked to play an interactive game that involved pretending to escape a plantation. The class was trying to find freedom on the Underground Railroad, where a roll of the dice determined whether a player would make it to the woods. The teacher may have been trying to make a dramatic point about the suffering imposed on slaves, but the 10-year-old took her history lesson to heart. She said she went back to the plantation 6 times. The girl experienced the painful lesson of consistently feeling degraded because every time her roll of the dice put her back on the plantation, she was beaten by the master. Yeah, not a great idea there, teach, for a game. Evidently, when the grandmother went to the elementary school, she said the teacher told her no one else complained about the history simulation game, to which the grandmother said, if we did a Holocaust game and people had to roll the dice if they were going to go in the gas chamber, do you see any similarity in that? Listen, I have a lot of respect for teachers. Teaching one class for the last, going on my 11th year, has given me such a respect for those who do it full time. I just can't even imagine. So I'm willing to cut teachers a lot of slack. But on this one, no, you deserve the What Were You Thinking Award of the Day. If you've got your own nominee, 573-4BREAD-4, give us a shout. We'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Let's look back in history at a few things that have happened on this day as well. August 29th throughout the ages. 1632, on this day, John Locke, the English philosopher, born on this day. Really, in many ways, the philosophic mind behind the American Revolution. Well, perhaps only appropriately, in 1786, on this day, just 10 years since the Declaration, Shays' Rebellion in Springfield, Massachusetts, the first major crisis of the infant republic, shows you that independence is not all it's cracked up to be. You know, being independent as a country, probably a lot like becoming a homeowner. You know, just like when you're a homeowner, you're wistful about the days as a renter, which you could just call the landlord when there was a problem. When you're now ruling your own country and things like rebellions that you yourself foisted upon your previous ruler break out, guess what? Only you're there to deal with it. In 1904, third modern Olympics games open in St. Louis. The first held in the U.S. I think they were moved to St. Louis to correspond with the World's Fair. In 1911, on this day, Ishii, who was considered the last Native American to make contact with European Americans, emerges from the wilderness of northeastern California. Wow. I don't know. Looking at my backyard right now, after all the rain we've had, there could be some other, who knows, who could be hiding and make contact back there. Need a little help with that. Sun couldn't get it done yesterday. 1920, Charlie Parker died. In 1955, he was born in 1920, died at the age of 34. Betty Lynn, also known as Thelma Lou, 90 years old today. And very interesting story. If I have time, I'll touch on that a little bit later in the program about her life and background. Pretty fascinating, actually. John McCain, the senator from Arizona, seeking re-election at the age of 80. His birthday today. Robin Leach, 75 years old. Michael Jackson would be 58. He's been dead 7 years. That's hard to believe. Mary Poppins released 52 years ago today. Saving Mr. Banks. That's an interesting movie. I know it's probably not fully true, but it's a good story anyway. Beatles' last concert at Candlestick Park on this day, 50 years ago, their last public concert. And on this day, 25 years ago, the Supreme Soviet Parliament of the USSR suspended all activities of the Communist Party, bringing an end to the institution. You know, it's a an important thing to, you know, history has a way of teaching us things. As I said earlier, the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist tells us not only how things happened, but usually how things always happen. Well, when you look back over history, look at the Soviet Union, for example, and the power of sort of Eastern Bloc communism, the oppressive scope of that government, and how throughout the years of really the Cold War in particular, there was a sense that this was going to be a permanent threat to world peace. And I'm sure no one would have ever imagined that this movement, which had gained such power and force and led to a great deal of suffering, I'm sure people thought it was firmly ensconced for generations to come. And yet how quickly, like a house of cards, the whole thing collapsed. That should give us pause when we are prone to despair about historical events. It should also give us humility, to be honest with you, about our own republic. We'll be back with more on the other side of the break. I want to talk about whose job is harder. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
By the way, I just posted a link to, I was talking on this day in history a minute ago about this Native American Ishi, who was reported to be the first or the last remaining Native American who had not had contact with the Western culture and so forth. He was, according to this Wikipedia, Ishi, who was born about 1861, died on March 25th, 1916, at the age of 55, was the last member of the Yahi, a group of the Yana of the U.S. state of California, widely acclaimed in his time as the last wild Indian. Weren't known back in the day for their cultural sensitivity by any means. In America, lived most of his life completely outside modern culture. At 50 years of age in 1911, he emerged near the present-day foothills of Lassen Peak. Ishi means man in the Yana language. The anthropologist Alfred Kroeber gave this name to the man because in the Yahi culture, tradition demanded that he not speak his name or that of anyone who was dead. When asked his name, he said, "I have none, because there were no people to name me," meaning that no Yahi had ever spoken his name. He was taken in by anthropologists at the University of California, who both studied him and hired him as a research assistant. He lived most of his remaining 5 years in a university building in San Francisco. Of course, he lacked immunity to some of the diseases of civilization. He was often ill. He ended up dying of tuberculosis in 1916. Interesting story. I just, like I said, I put a link to it on the show's Facebook page. You can check it out. Again, my question of the day, in anticipation of a conversation I'll have next hour with Rick Becker about the correspondence between Evelyn Waugh, the British novelist, and Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk and priest who wrote The Seven Story Mountain. We'll talk about their exchanges with Rick Becker in the next hour and what it can teach us. But I'm asking about handwritten letters. Do you still send handwritten letters in the mail, the old snail mail? And if so, how often do you do it and to whom? Call or text 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I was talking earlier about the horrific events in Syria over the weekend, in Aleppo, and barrel bombs being dropped on people gathered to mourn, and just the mess of a situation there where you've got such a difficult to decipher dilemma, where you've got an oppressive regime there. You've got rebels. You've also got mixed into that whole cauldron there. You've got the prevalence of ISIS and other violent jihadists. And it really is a difficult circumstance when you think about diplomacy from a U.S. perspective about what to do. You want to attack ISIS, and yes, ISIS is somehow enmeshed and intertwined. You also don't want to empower a despotic regime, and yet at the same time, like I guess in some ways with Saddam Hussein, Hussein was a scoundrel, but he kept some degree of order and protection for some parts of the population, including Christians. I think this is what has been difficult to decipher for the U.S. throughout the whole Middle East and some areas of Northern Africa. I think the same thing is true in Turkey. What parts of the so-called Arab Spring do you support? In doing so, are you facilitating more radical Islamic regimes that are going to commit atrocities against religious minorities? And then I was reading a piece this weekend from the magazine Quartz, which is really an excellent online publication. I recommend it. It said some Catholics are deeply disturbed that the Vatican is cozying up to China's regime. You know, and the article goes on to talk about some of the difficulties in China, particularly with the Catholic Church, because the Chinese government has been really at odds, the People's Republic of China, been at odds with the Vatican for a long, long time about who has the authority to name bishops. The Vatican, of course, insisting that any valid bishops would be chosen, selected, appointed by Rome. But China wanting to pick who they think will be politically favorable persons to be bishops. And so they've been in many ways at loggerheads. And that tension is manifest in the tensions within the Catholic Church in China, where you have the so-called Patriotic Church, those who recognize and submit to the bishops who have been appointed by China, who, by the way, are valid bishops because they have been ordained by someone who is a successor to the apostles. They are illicit, though. And so you've got those who are the Chinese Patriotic Catholic Association, who are sort of above ground. And then you've got the underground church, those who refuse to submit to bishops that Rome has not approved, and the much larger underground church. Well, the stakes in China are enormous because it's been speculated that within a few decades, China could be the most populous Catholic country in the world. Could be more Catholics in China than any other country. And so for some time now, Rome has been reaching out to China, hoping to repair and establish stronger relations, maybe even pave the way for a papal visit. Of course, at the same time, you've got some great difficulties. You've got the government there in Taiwan, who consider themselves to be the legitimate rump, let's say, rulers of China, driven there after Mao's communist revolution back in the 40s, and who are insulted by the idea of Rome establishing some sort of a greater rapprochement, however you say it in French, with China. And then you've got those who have been oppressed by the regime, who are afraid that basically the Vatican is going to do all the giving and none of the receiving when it comes to concessions in building a relationship with China. And yet then you have others who, like the cardinal in Hong Kong, I think it's Cardinal Tong, who assures people that any sort of reconciliation between Rome and Beijing will not be at the expense of Chinese Catholics. Reading the article, and believe me, this is not my wheelhouse of knowledge enough for me to weigh in, but I was struck by the fact about how complicated it is to be the Pope. You got so many competing concerns on so many different places. Not only do you have to have the concern about what your relationship with a particular government, let's say through diplomacy, is going to say to the rest of the world, but is it going to make life easier or harder for Catholics in that country, for the members of your flock? And there's a lot of misunderstanding about the very delicate sort of situation oftentimes that the Vatican finds itself in. This was true during the Second World War. This is one of the reasons that Pope Pius XII has been so unfairly maligned, as he knew that there were certain things, if he said them publicly, there would be repercussions against Catholics in those communities by the Nazis. And as the chief shepherd of the church, he had concern for his flock. Now, he has been largely vindicated, and many of the caricatures of him as being a Nazi sympathizer have been so thoroughly discredited now. But you can see how difficult it gets and the struggle. And so it got me wondering, and I want to kind of revisit this question maybe as we go through the week. Be interested if you've got a thought on this. Who has the harder job? Honestly. Who has the harder job? President Obama or Pope Francis? Now, if you go by sheer numbers, you know, President Obama presides over, what, 300 million Americans? And he also, in many ways, you know, shares leadership responsibility with two other branches of government. Whereas Pope Francis presides as chief shepherd of over 1 billion Catholics. And not just one country, but a multiplicity of countries. The church is Catholic. It is universal. So who has the harder job? I don't know on that. I tell you who seems to enjoy their job more, I think, at least appears to, is Pope Francis than President Obama. I actually tend to think that the Pope has the tougher job. The Pope definitely, I think, has, in my view, has the tougher job. But you may disagree. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Well, you may say, well, the Pope really has no temporal power. Nobody has a particular moral authority and certainly a spiritual burden that he carries for the state of the world. You can see why Pope Benedict felt the need to resign, exhausted as he was, and yet there's also a certain marveling at Pope Francis running around basically with one lung, pushing 80, with what seems to be a relentless energy that must be spirit-given. If you got a thought on that, I really would love to hear it. 573-4BREAD-4. Whose job is harder, Pope or President? We got a new hour coming up, including my conversation with Rick Becker about the correspondence of Evelyn Waugh and Thomas Merton. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.